Hello and welcome to Raising a Pro. My name is Annie Apple, journalist and NFL mom to my son, Eli Apple. Today is an important show. Well, all the shows are important, but today a little bit more so right now. A few weeks ago, a tweet went viral after the death of retired NFL wide receiver Vincent Jackson, who played 12 years in the league. The tweet's author was Greg Camarillo, former NFL wide receiver who played with the Chargers, Dolphins, Vikings, and Saints. Greg now works with student athletes at San Diego State and is also an analyst on a local NBC station in San Diego. Well, Greg's tweets were talking about the adjustments of life after football, the challenges, and how hard it is to find a new normal. The tweets were vulnerable, they were honest, and they tugged at the heart. They were so profound and powerful that I had to hear more. Before we get started in more about you, I just want to go to a tweet that you tweeted February the 15th, because it really caught me. And I think it caught a lot of people, but I just want to quote you right here real quick. It says, "Football players struggle when our careers are over. It's hard. We have been football players for years. It's been what we do, what we know, and a big part of who we are. And then it's gone. A big part of our identity lost. Football is the ultimate team sport. We are taught to bury our problems and pains for the benefits of the team. In a game, that works. But in life, that's dangerous. The mentality of suck it up or fight through it doesn't work in real life." So tell me more about what made you decide to really share this, because it was very vulnerable. It was very honest and it was very raw. And I, as a mom of a pro athlete, it tugged at my heart. So I just wanted to, you know, chat about that.
Those weren't new thoughts. You know, I retired from the NFL in 2012. And during my transition, was thinking a lot about it, you know, what was difficult, why it was difficult. And now I work with student athletes. I'm an academic counselor at the University of San Diego. So part of my job is to prepare student athletes for their transition. And so I share my story with my student athletes every year to kind of prepare them, but also to get them to open up. If I can show you my struggles, there's a better chance you're going to show me your struggles. I decided to tweet it, and it was after hearing of Vincent Jackson's death, who was a former teammate, a friend, my camp roommate, somebody I was close with when I was playing and I hadn't talked to him in a while. But that just felt like time to share. Like, you know, you see these deaths, you hear of these tragic deaths, but people don't often understand what's behind that. And I don't know Vince's individual situation, but I could speak more generally on the transition that football players go through. And I just felt like sharing and didn't realize it would take off like that.
It definitely took off, because I'm going to quote a little bit more, because I think many times as athletes, you know how the game is. They looked at the players as gladiators, you know, just machines out there, but they're not machines. They're human. They're people with feelings, with emotions, people who hurt. And I just want to go and read another tweet that you had. You said, and I quote, "We often reach a pinnacle at a young age. Our childhood dreams have come to fruition. Then around 30, we start over. How will we ever achieve something this great again? Will I ever feel this excitement or pride again? It's hard to deal with. You know, our conversation, this is the part I like. Our conversations with friends and family are always about football. People love talking about the game. So do we. And then suddenly is, what are you doing now? What's next? A strictly regimented life is now wide open. The adjustment is hard." End quote. That's powerful.
Yeah. And that was some of the more difficult parts for me. So I was 30 years old when, you know, it's hard to say even retired, because I didn't like pick a day and say I'm done with football. Football was more done with me than I was done with football.
So football broke up with you first.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Football sent me a text and said it's over.
I know.
And I tried to hold on. But
I mean, it's not you, it's me. No, it is you.
And I didn't want to hear it. But, you know, it is one of the hardest things for me is laying in bed at 30 years old. And, you know, when I was done with football, I had my first child like 2 months later. So I got to dive right into being a dad. But it's so different than the highs you get from playing football.
So you mean changing diapers was not as high as
at
all?
Waking up at 3 a.m. to change a diaper and getting peed on is just not the same as playing football. The feeling of have I peaked in life at 30, given that you've got, let's just say, 50 more years to live, it's a tough pill to swallow. As a NFL player, you're highly motivated to achieve playing in the NFL. Otherwise, you wouldn't have the work ethic to get there. I went to Stanford. I majored in engineering while playing football. I was always a very driven individual. And then suddenly there wasn't anything to drive towards, or I didn't know what to drive towards. And so I didn't have somewhere to put that energy. I didn't have somewhere to wake up and say, you know what, today I'm going to do this to get better at this so I can achieve this. You know, I wanted to be the best dad I had. I put my energy into that, but it's just not the same. There's not a daily goal or a weekly goal or a season goal that you can achieve in a lot of other things that football can give you. And so I struggled with, where am I going to go? Where am I going to put this passion? What am I going to do? And then even if I do that, will I ever feel the same way again? Will I ever get to run out into a stadium through the team helmet with the smoke coming out? You know, will I ever have the feeling of teammates high-fiving me for a good job?
And that's the thing, the camaraderie. You're used to being with all these guys and all of a sudden it's just you.
It's a great feeling to be in what I think is the ultimate team sport with football, because the teams are so big. Everyone's pushing in the same direction. You are all working for a goal together. And that's a great feeling. And then suddenly you're by yourself. And even if you do find your own goal, it's your goal. There's very few things where 60 people are pushing in the same direction trying to achieve greatness. And so there's a void. There is a void there on your schedule, on your passion, on your energy, on your excitement. And that was a hard thing for me to cope with.
And on your time.
And on your time.
Definitely. So let's go back to your story in the beginning. Your background, I found extremely fascinating. You're Jewish and American Mexican. Father was born in California, professor, Mexican American professor. So how do you think when you played versus what, let's just say, college kids are experiencing now as far as like racial makeup and the importance of an environment that breeds equality, an environment that nurtures? How did you handle that whole, you all together, but you come from different backgrounds, different ethnicity? How do you see it changing from then to now in how coaches address issues of race?
Yeah, I think the difference now is students feel more empowered to speak up when they're subjected to a racist act, or when they're not given a platform to speak up. They're encouraged, or more encouraged. And I can't speak for everyone, but from my perspective, working with student athletes directly, students, I'm hoping, are feeling more empowered to speak up. Athletic departments are understanding the need to support their students of color. Athletic departments are usually the most diverse department on campus. And up until this point, there's been very little done to understand the needs of students of color and address them and better serve them. So I'm hoping that students today, from when I graduated in 2004, that athletic departments understand the importance of supporting their students of color and giving them a platform to try to create change. As far as in the locker room, the NFL is generally based on merit. And I'm not talking overall, and I'm not talking about the financial aspect. I'm just talking about, if you're good at football, you're going to play. And there's a lot of inequities getting there. You know, some people can afford private coaches and weight rooms and all that. I'm avoiding that. Once you get to the locker room, the best person is most likely going to play. And so if you can play, there's a good chance you're going to be accepted into a locker room, as long as you're not an a-hole, which some guys are. But if you play well, if you're a good teammate, you just get along. And it's good to see. And there's still racial tension. I'm not going to lie and say it's a wonderful world. But if you can play football, if you can work hard, if you can add value to the team, your teammates recognize that and it creates a bond.
Well, let's go back to you, because you had an opportunity when you came out of high school. You could either go to Harvard, but you chose Stanford. So let's go ahead and make all the Harvard people cry. What made you pick Stanford over Harvard?
Oh, man. Harvard made me cry. So I'm from California, born and raised in the Bay Area, where it gets cool, but not cold. It doesn't snow. And I went on a college trip to go visit Harvard, University of Pennsylvania, where my brother was. And then I was meeting a couple friends in Miami for spring break. So as an 18-year-old, I was excited about Miami. So all I brought was a sweatshirt, thinking I'd be fine. So I show up to Boston at Harvard with a sweatshirt.
Wow.
In April. And they have, I think, 6 a.m. football practice outside. And I was frozen, like literally frozen.
Oh, my God. No one told you?
I mean, I just, maybe they did. I didn't know.
But you're such a California mind.
Yeah, we don't know what cold is. Yes. And so I was frozen and thought there's no chance I could play football in this weather. And then Stanford gave me a chance to walk on. And, you know, the shot at playing Power Five football, even if I never saw the field, was attractive to me. So I went for it.
There's a quote that I want to kind of highlight real quick. A few days before your final home game at Stanford, You spoke at a booster breakfast, and during questioning, a Stanford announcer asked you this question: how does it feel knowing you're going to play organized football for the last time in your life? You said it stung. What made that remark?
Oh, man. Sting?
I know, I'm almost like, let me move on before you. It's like somebody having your professional funeral when you just started.
I was like so mad inside. And so I'm going into my last game, and the guy's just telling me, this is your last game. You'll never play football again. Even if that's the case, like, I wasn't supposed to play in the NFL. Like, don't tell somebody that in an interview.
Who is this guy? Let's find him.
Oh, he's passed away. So I don't want to be too mean to him, but he said a few mean things to me along the way. But I had to drive to play football and keep playing football. My last 3 years in college were not very good. We had 10 wins over 3 years, so we sucked. And I wanted to keep playing. I was going to play in arena leagues, which I actually went to a tryout for 3 days. I would play in Canada. I was going to play in NFL Europe. Wherever I could play football, I was going to play football. And this guy just took a dump on my dreams right in front of a whole group of people. But that, as a walk-on, as an undrafted guy, you get used to that negativity. And it actually adds fuel to your fire. You look for motivation. This guy hating on me, it was motivation to try to prove him wrong.
Wow. I think about your tweets and I think about the reality of football in the sense of, now, we didn't put, I say we, it's to be nice. Being a mom, I always think about mental health. I always think about emotional wellness. You know, how are you doing? You know, I love that. You know, what brings me joy about the game is watching Eli enjoy playing. Recently, I had the pleasure of interviewing Penny Bennett, Michael Bennett's mom, Mr. Super Bowl himself.
Yeah.
She talked about him being undrafted. She talked about that feeling how, you know, he went fishing during the last, because he just couldn't sit there anymore. And when he come back to realize that, you know, you haven't been drafted, he's a big guy. She was just like, it took him. It was hard for him. I mean, he went on to win a Super Bowl, would have won 2 Super Bowls if they would have given a ball to Beast Mode, but whatever. I'm still going to be upset about that forever. That's not even my team or my son.
That's fair.
But I think people don't understand, what was that emotionally like for you to be undrafted, you know, get signed by San Diego, and then you're there, then you go on to another team. And then what is that process emotionally like?
Yeah. Wow. I could take you on a long journey with this one, but
I got time, baby. I got time.
All right, let's do it. So I wasn't expecting to be drafted. I never started in college. I never had big stats. I was just hoping for an opportunity to be a free agent. So for the last day of the draft, my sister, who had always been a big supporter of me coming to all my games, had a dance recital. So I went to her dance recital, and I'm thinking, as long as I get out of here as the draft ends, I'm going to be fine. I didn't know they call free agents during the final rounds of the draft. So it's like a big dance hall kind of place. It's dark. Some little girl is doing a terrible dance up on a stage. Because of that, I got to look at my phone. So 619 lights up, and I go to answer my phone, but I'm in a quiet dance recital. I can't answer my phone right there. So I bolt for the exit, and there's a grandma that's guarding the door telling me I can't exit the door until the dance is over.
The militant grandma.
Yeah, I mean, she was trying to be nice about it, but the old lady was holding me back. So I had to give her a football move. I gave her the swim move, and I burst out of the door. And it was Coach James Lofton, a Hall of Fame wide receiver with the San Diego Chargers, offering me a chance to try out. And I was ecstatic. I got a call from an NFL team.
Did you start dancing right away? Did you
I should have got dancing? On the stage and started dancing. So it was a different experience for me. I was just ecstatic that my phone rang. And then every step of the way, I had a 3-day tryout. I thought that would be the end of my career and I would have 3 days and it would be amazing. That turned into an invite to training camp. Thought I'd be in training camp and that would be amazing. And then I ended up taking it to 8 years. To kind of talk about what you mentioned, the emotional roller coaster, I'll tell you about 2010, coming off of an injury in Miami training camp. I'm called in. I've been on the team for 3 years. I've started for 2. I just get a tap on the shoulder in training camp in meetings about 8, 9, 10 a.m. or so. And they're like, GM wants to meet with you. So I go meet with the GM. He says, Greg, you know why you're here? No, you've been traded to Minnesota. My wife now was my fiance then, owned a house in Florida, had a dog. My wife had just started graduate school 2 or 3 days before, and your world just gets flipped upside down. And granted, it's to continue your career, it's to continue getting paid well. But the emotional roller coaster of having a set life, like things were going well. I felt at home in South Florida. From the minute he told me I was traded, I had 4 hours to get on a plane and move to Minnesota. the offensive coordinator came, we cried it out together, and I couldn't figure out like what my next move was. So I decided to get a haircut so I would show up at my new team with a fresh haircut. And that made me feel better. But there was an emotional roller coaster of having to move all the time, the fear of always getting cut, the fear of always getting traded. It is tough to deal with, but that's just the nature of the NFL.
I think people think because, oh, we're paying you a lot of money, so your emotions, your mental, none of that matters. You're getting paid, so just go out there. But it is a lot. At least you got called into the office. A lot of guys don't even find out till they're watching TV.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
A few weeks ago, I was reading the LA Times and Jared Goff, which I thought was such a great interview that he did because he was so honest. He was so vulnerable. And he talked about he didn't have a conversation with McVay. He said they never had a talk. He said he wished somebody would have come and told him, hey, we're changing direction, right?
Mm-hmm.
How is that? You know, let's talk a little bit more about what that does to you. You're so dispensable.
Yeah, it's stressful, incredibly stressful. So to address the money factor, money can reduce certain stressors. Like, you know, you don't have to worry about covering your rent. If you get traded, you can afford to move. There's money eliminates certain stressors. But what it cannot eliminate are mental health issues. You know, the stress of getting cut. I reached a point in my fourth year where I was just ready to get cut. I was so stressed out. I didn't
you
like...
You went into the office. Are you going to cut me today?
I was ready to go. I was so stressed out that I would, if they cut me that day, I would have just packed in my bag and been like, thanks, I'm good. Money can't help the stress of the fear of getting cut. You know, the highs and lows, the emotional roller coaster of success and failure, that is a big one. And then you're just in a high risk, high reward business. You put yourself out there to be critiqued in everything. Every little thing you do gets critiqued.
You're living every day. You have to go out there and perform. But just think about the mental stress constantly, consistently.
Yeah. 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 People often ask me, where, you know, what was your favorite team that you played for? And my favorite time was in San Diego. I had 0 catches, 2 years, 0 catches, but I had a blast. The team culture was amazing. And Marty Schottenheimer, who just passed away, the best coach I ever played for, created an amazing culture. And in the NFL, you know, you can get cut. We see people come and go all the time, but he didn't like drill it home every day. Like, go out there and play well, you're getting cut. In Miami, where I had my best statistical careers, I had the vast majority of my catches in Miami. I enjoyed it way less than in San Diego, where I was barely playing, because of the culture of if you get hurt, you cut. If you mess up, you're cut. If you drop a couple passes, you're cut. Literally every day I feared for my job for 3 years. Imagine going home at the end of this podcast and thinking, okay, I'm going to have to change careers because I messed up a question. That stress, we subject ourselves to that stress. So I'm not asking for any sympathy. I'm just trying to paint a picture of what it's like. That's the stress of going home every day thinking, not just I might lose some playing time, but I might get cut and my job might not be here and I might have to change the whole trajectory of my life. It's a lot to deal with.
But let's talk about what made Marty Schottenheimer's culture so good.
A few things. One was respect. He gave it and required it. That was step one.
Key word, he gave it.
He gave it. Oh, yeah.
So many require it, but they don't give it.
He gave it every day. And I'm at the bottom of the roster kind of guy. I was a practice squad guy, a tryout guy. And every day that I went there, you know, I felt respected by him. Like he was going to give me a shot and be honest to me. So that's another one, his honesty. So after my first year, they cut you to put you on practice squads. Every time they cut you, you meet with the coach. And he just flat out told me, he's like, Greg, I see you being a good receiver in this league, but because of your speed, you'll never be a great receiver. And I loved that. I thought that, you know, to me, that was a confidence booster. Some eyes might look at that like, why can't I be great? But it was brutally honest, gave us some ownership. So at the beginning of the season, we had a team meeting to set goals. He sets what he needs and then left the room and said, the rest of the goals are up for you guys. You guys make your goals. This is your team. You tell me where you want to go. And so that gave us kind of a sense of ownership, you know, like, okay, you know, coach trusts in us. Coach knows that for us all to push in the same direction, he wants to hear where we want to go. So that was a big part of ownership. And then a quote from him, and this isn't a direct quote, but pretty close. He said, I'm not going to treat everyone the same, but I'm going to treat everyone fairly. That's all I could ask for. You combine all those things and it just created a great team culture, and we were good and we were winning, and I enjoyed that.
And I think you felt valued. I think that that's the key. Your value wasn't based on, hey, your stat. Your value was based on as a member of the team. A very good friend of mine, Sherry Shepherd, whose son Sterling Shepherd plays for the Giants. She's also a human resources executive. And so we talked about, okay, what is it that you would like to see different in the league? And she said, you know what? The hardest thing about the league, she's like, I don't like the way they treat the players is so disposable. It's very rare that you are valued. And I think it starts with the top. Like you said, it starts with the culture, right?
Absolutely. Most guys know they're a commodity. We understand that ultimately this is a business, that the NFL is about making money through the entertainment of sport. And we are the commodity that delivers that entertainment. But that doesn't mean you can't approach it as humans. You know, that doesn't mean that you can't approach individuals as humans. Exactly. You can see it in business all the time. You look at right now, Costco versus like Walmart.
Everybody else.
Yeah.
With the minimum wage, right?
Costco raises their minimum wage. They rarely ever fire anyone, and they have a great culture. People start there and they spend their entire career there, and they still make a lot of money. So there's a way to treat human beings as humans and not commodities and still be good at your business. And some teams are good at that and some teams are not. It takes bouncing around to figure that out, because you know, you start at one team that treats you as a commodity, then that's just what you think the culture is. I 100% agree. It starts at the top, how the ownership and the GM and the president and the coach set that culture is how it's going to trickle down all the way through.
Let's make you the commissioner for 1 minute. What would you do to make this league a little bit more mentally less challenging for players? What can we do to make this league that players come in? Yes, you're a commodity, but you're still human. What can we do to make this a more human league for the players?
Wow, that is a great question. I wish I had that answer. I would call Raj up right now. To be honest with you, and this isn't going to solve the problem, but what I learned from the different teams that I had, one is how often do they talk about the threat of cutting? And I don't think Roger can change that. That's just how different coaches approach it. I think one, it's honesty. So I spent my final season with the Saints. I was cut basically every 2 weeks, depending on who was injured and what they needed. And they were—
Yeah, they finally cut you for Jonathan Vilma, yeah, right?
But they were 100% honest the entire time. Like I had a pregnant wife at home, so I couldn't just like float around New Orleans while my wife was at home. They were like, Greg, we're going to cut you. We think we're going to bring you back in 2 weeks. We're not 100% sure. Do you want to stay here or do you want to go home? It was that simple. A lot of teams will say, look, I think we might need you in 2 days. Stick around and work out here. And then knowing they're not going to call somebody for another month. So that honesty made me feel like a human. That honesty from Marty Schottenheimer made me feel like they valued me because they could be real with me. Roger Goodell, I get no honesty from him. And all of the business dealings and all of the concussion stuff, it's just PR statement, HR statement, like just be real. And you are the head of this gigantic entity. And a fine example would be the NFL's push for social justice with no mention of Colin Kaepernick.
That was crazy. And the whole, it takes all of us.
Yeah. Well, you're leaving out one that's real important. Yeah. Like, let's just be honest. Just be honest. And
but you know what? In defense of Roger, is that Roger or is it the ownership? Because I think what people don't understand is that he works for them. I know he's the face and he's the representative, but at the end of the day, those 32 owners are the ones who make the decisions, right?
Yes. But at some point, as a leader, you need to choose money or values. We go back to the Costco example. Is it about maximizing how much money I can make these owners? Or at some point, are my personal values going to jump in there? And they don't have to be separate. You can still make a lot of money and align
the money and still align
with your values. So to me, I think one of the key components is honesty. And the teams that have been most honest with me gave me the best experience.
I think for me, when I look at it, I think the key word that comes out for me, if I had to play commissioner, would be accountability to the teams, right? Because I think a lot of teams, as long as you're winning, that's all matters. I think accountability to how you treat your players, accountability for what kind of culture you have. So it's not a culture that's detrimental to women or a culture that's detrimental to African-American fairness.
Washington.
Oh my God. Can you say Washington? But because a lot of it is, so I think accountability, we have to implement ways on where there are checks and balances so those abuses are not happening.
I like that.
And I think, like you said, you can do that. You can do it and still make money. Money's not going anywhere. Let me tell you something. The fans are going to watch this game until Jesus comes. And Jesus might just sit and watch the first half. Then he'll be like, all right, everybody, it's time to go.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
No, like, I think you're spot on. The fine example is the Washington football team. You have been sexist to your cheerleaders on and off again. You had a racist name forever. At least they changed that. But nothing happened. Like, literally nothing happened.
Nothing.
They're going to add men to the cheerleading team. That's a step, but nothing happened to the owner. If you want that to stop, I 100% agree. You have to hold him accountable for bad behavior.
No accountability at all. And let's throw in Robert Kraft.
Oh.
And the whole I'm just saying, like, it starts. I mean, I'm sorry.
Oh, I'm all about Patriot bashing, so let's do it.
I know the man's trying to get whatever little freak he can on, but I mean, like, at the end of the day, you can't just say to the players, hey, you know, hell for you if you do this, but no accountability on the top. And I think that the culture that Marty instilled, it's not something that's impossible. Treating people with respect should not be hard.
Agreed.
And honesty should not be hard. Agreed. But it starts up top. There has to be a way where there's accountability to make sure those things happen.
Annie, you need a job in the league office.
You know, I'm just,
league mom.
League mom. I think it's so important because I think, you know, as a mother, not just a mother, as a professional and just somebody who, when you love the game, you have to love those on the field that's given it all they have.
Agreed. And it's just like Marty said, it's, you don't have to treat everyone the same, but you got to treat everyone fairly. That is something that I live by, that I learned from Marty. And I think a lot of people can learn from that too.
You talked about after you're done playing, the idea of losing your identity. What can families of athletes, you know, we're about to embark on a new draft class. How can they really help their sons to really maintain their identity? I know for me, one thing that was very important to me with Eli, you know, he has success in college and all that stuff. Whenever he came home, this was just my personal thing. I didn't have newspaper clippings everywhere. I didn't have any of that because we're not creating a museum. You know, you're my son. When you come home, this is home. And I always told him, don't believe your own hype. You won't have to worry about the hate. So for me, it wasn't about, oh, when people praise you, because one day they love you. The next day, they're ready to crucify you.
Yeah. You know, the journey, let me start by saying the journey is different for everyone. I just had a Zoom call with former teammates from the Chargers. The Chargers created a Zoom call just for us to talk about it.
And that is so awesome.
It was great. It was the first one. And it was just interesting to hear how different kind of each person's retirement journey is. But for me personally, and what I teach my student athletes, it's about building identities that are not reliant on football. And so I showed my students a model. I picture a Jenga stack. We've all played Jenga, right? So each one of those little blocks is an identity, a part of you. It could be, you know, your race, your religion, your gender, your profession, your relationships. A big chunk of that is being an athlete. And for NFL football players, it is a big chunk. So let's just say 50% of that Jenga tower is football. The key for me, and I think the key for other people as well, is to develop identities that can sit below the foundation of football, because at some point that football chunk is getting pulled out of there. And if every identity above it relies on being a football player, that's all crumbling with it. But if you can build identities that don't rely on being a football player, once you pull football out, there'll be a void, but the foundation will still be there. So to me, it's like I'm a man and I identify as being a man, not related to football. I'm not a man because I was good at football. I'm not a man because I was strong in the weight room, even though I wasn't that strong compared to other guys. You know, I'm a man because, you know, I'm honest. I help out with my family. I'm a good family man. I take care of my kids, things like that. So for me, it was about who am I away from football? And that's what allowed me to, and I'm not going to say I didn't struggle, but it made my struggle less because I had other things to go back on. I still identify as an engineer, even though I graduated in 2005 and haven't worked as an engineer a day since. So I think for parents, talking about things other than football, it's totally fine to talk about football. That's a huge part of your son's life. But what is your son doing outside of football that you can also talk about? You know, let's talk about that class or maybe this, you know, a community service project that your son is working on. What can we talk about to develop an identity that's not just football based?
Let me ask you something. What did your parents do well?
They required that I be good at school, you know, and supported me through that. It was always school first. It was, you know, I had to handle business in school and they supported me along the way. I come from a family of educators. My dad was a professor for his entire career. My mom, a middle school counselor. So school was always the first push. And because they gave me the support to be good at school, doors opened, opportunities opened because of that. I played college football because I was good at school. They always supported whatever passion I wanted to go for. Football was a long shot for me. And they were just like, you know what? After I graduated, I moved back home for a couple months and they said, go ahead and train and try to make it. They always gave me love and support no matter what I was doing. It made me feel stable.
And you know what? And I have to quote in closing, one of your tweets, you said, quote, physical pain can take a toll, memory problems, aching knees, restless nights. It all adds up. You never know what someone is dealing with, the battles they are fighting. We all go through it. It's okay to need help. We all need help at some point. You know, how were you able to recognize that, hey, I need help?
That's a great question. I love free shit. And so the NFL gives you a lot of free stuff when you're done. You get free career counseling, free, you know, medical exams, free.
But a lot of guys don't know this. Or I guess you're just like, I'm done right now. I don't want to see your face. I don't know what it is.
There's definitely a period where you're done and want to separate. I think the biggest problem is in the world of football, we're taught to suck it up for the benefit of the team. And that works fine in football. If you've got a little injury, don't bring that, you know, take a pill, you know, go to the trainer, get your ass out on the field. If you've got a little something wrong at home, you're going through some relationship issues, you know, don't bring that into the meeting room, get out on the field. We need 60 guys pointed in one direction so we can achieve this goal. But that doesn't work in real life. If you have a relationship issue and you ignore it, it's not going to go away. If you have a relationship issue and you take a pill or you drink, it's not going to go.
And all the ladies in America say amen. Yes. It won't go away. You got to address it.
I mean, I think the mentality needs to be, if you have a muscle injury, you go to the trainer, you get it fixed so you can be 100%. If you have a broken bone, you go to the doctor, you get a cast so you can go get it fixed. If you are dealing with something else, I think the mentality needs to be, let me go see a medical professional so I can get fixed and go be 100%. It's the same thing. If you're dealing with depression, you're not going to be 100%. There are professionals that can get you back towards 100%. And so it is not as easy as just saying, hey, let's have a mindset shift. It is a difficult thing to break down that mentality of, I don't need help. I'll fight through this and I'm going to be fine. But I think the more that we just talk about it like this, the more that guys say, you know, I have a therapist, and it just becomes accepted. It'll take a long time, but I think we approach it in a mindset where you look at it as, who can help me get back to 100%, whether that's a physical injury or a mental health issue.
And realizing that your mental health is just as important as your physical health.
Yep, absolutely.
What is one important lesson you think that football taught you?
One important lesson is something that I tell to my daughters is, and this is really just life in general, but in football, you can measure it better. Always do your best. And that sounds real simple, but something I miss about football is the feeling of knowing that you did your best. When you go into a weight room and you can't walk out of it, you get instant gratification that you did your best. When you're running for conditioning and you throw up, you know you did your best. I miss that feeling of busting my ass and knowing I gave it all. In real life, I don't get that. I can change as many diapers as I want at 3 a.m. I don't get that feeling. I could write 20 perfectly worded emails for work. I don't get that feeling. And so football just taught me that feeling of giving it your all and knowing you gave it your all, and how good that feels to just know you put everything out there. And that's a great lesson in life. Approach everything that same way. Do your best every time.
Wow, what a powerful conversation. So many great nuggets in there to inspire. What stood out most for me in this conversation is the importance of firming up your own identity. You know, who you are outside of what you do or what you have. Which leads me to today's Annie's Clapback. Identity is who you are to yourself. Identity is your own inward lenses, controlling how you see the world and yourself. Don't allow people and things outside of yourself to hijack your identity and your divine self. And as always, thank you all for listening. Raising a Pro is part of the Audio Boom Originals Network. If you haven't already done so, please don't forget to hit that follow button on your podcast app so you don't miss any new episodes. And also, don't forget to rate and review. See you next time, family.